We hope no one would consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that the alcoholic men and women in this room, desperately in need, will hear our speaker tonight, and we believe it's only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that we will all be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. But we have a guest that has come back to visit that has frequented this room, especially when I first began my experience with AA here at NABA, Dick H. He's very active in the Winter Circle, the Methodist Church in Chamblee, Dunwoody. Has a speaker meeting there on Saturday nights. I do highly recommend that. Very talented musician as well, and just a fabulous story. Glad that I have the opportunity now to hear it again. And a very courageous AA, Dick H.
Nice to see you're still foolish.
Hey, all, I'm Dick. I'm an alcoholic. Or maybe I should say I'm playing video. I'm an alcoholic. You know, one of the two. It's nice to be back here. I see some familiar faces and some faces that were new when I was here the last time. And if you're still here, that must mean things are going well for you. I wasn't planning on doing this tonight, but, you know, God has this way of just doing things for us that we can't do for ourselves, you know. I left out of the house and I was pissed off tonight. And so I figured the best place for me to go when I'm pissed off is go to a meeting. And my lovely wife and my lovely bride of 36 years, and I had some differences in opinion. And so normally, I'm the one in the wrong. So I figured it was best I go somewhere so God could do for me what I couldn't do for myself. Because if I kept thinking about it and I kept stewing on it, things were not going to be good. So here I am. My sobriety date is May 6, 1995. I got sober at Peachford, when Peachford was Charter Peachford. And my sponsor is Ernie Cook, and has been since day one. Even though he's moved out of town, he's still my sponsor. And I have been chairman of the Winter Circle now for gosh, 13 years. And we love the meeting. We'd love to have any of you there. We're on Thursday night. We do a open discussion. And Saturday night is two speakers, two 20-minute speakers. But anyway, and some of you I know here have been over there. My story starts out just like anybody else's. I was that square peg round hole guy, you know. And never felt good enough. Never felt good enough in the family. Never felt good enough at school. My brother was big in sports. I was a musician. I didn't give a shit about sports. So, you know, I mean, it was, and my dad was big into sports. So, you know, I just kind of was left on my own for a long time. And, going way back, you know, I was born of parents that were German, Irish, and Cajun. So, you know, you put those three things together and that spells trouble. You know, I was born and raised in Louisiana. And in Louisiana, well, you know, at Disneyland when you go and they have these signs that say you have to be this high to ride the rides. In Louisiana, you have to be that tall to buy liquor. You know, if you can see over the counter, you can get it. And but the problem was is we didn't have any money, so we stole it. And the first time the cops got involved in my life about liquor, I was 8 years old. Yep. We had started just before school got out. There was a whole group of us on Dogwood, and they called us the Dogwood Hoods. And we went around in this small little town of 1,700 people that had three grocery stores, and everybody knew everybody by first name, and we decided to shoplift because we were going to have a party. So we started shoplifting liquor, and shoplifting liquor, and shoplifting liquor, and shoplifting liquor. I made the smart move by going to visit my grandparents for a week. And while I was there, all hell broke loose on Dogwood Drive, I'm telling you. And I got back just as it was coming to a close. And we had been storing this in a friend of mine's attic. We didn't know what we had. We just kept doing it because of the thrill, I guess, you know. And his mother was a drunk. She didn't believe that when the cops came, she didn't believe her son was involved in it. They made him get up in the attic, get it all down. They had a double carport, and there were three lines all the way across of fists, pints, bottles of beer, cans of beer, you name it, and 240-something packs of cigarettes. What in the hell were 8-year-old kids going to do with all that? I got no idea, but we was going to have a party. Well, and the next time I got in trouble, I was 12 years old, and that was my first band's first job. And I had some Boone's Farm under my jacket, a couple of them. And, you know, that was just to lubricate our fingers so we could play a little bit better, you know. The more we drank, the better we thought we sounded. That was us. At any rate, leaving that alone, I grew up apart from, you know, I started playing in bands when I was young, and that lasted all the way through my teen years and into my early 20s. And I started dating this old gal in high school. I kind of liked her. She's all right. And I dated her for about 4 years and then got married to her right after I got out of high school, and I'm still married to her. Well, you know, I wonder after everything I put her through, and vice versa now, but I take my blame that, you know, I wonder if she's a saint or just purely insane. But I'm leaning towards a purely insane tonight, to tell you the truth, but I'm going to back away from that a little bit. She's not here to defend herself. I'm sure she'd have a few things to tell me. But we had on December 31st, 1976, we had a little boy, and I figured I might slow down my shenanigans at that time, and I think I did for a while. I was besides being in the band, I was in the high end clothing business, and that led you to, that was just a culture of drunks. That's all it was just, you know, cocktail parties every other night, this, that, and the other, and yeah, that's what you involved in. And the company I was with, when he was 4 years old, went out of business. And so, you know, being the good alcoholic that I am, I couldn't go down in my status, my position, because I was general merchandise manager. I was the big cheese at a very young age. And so I got, the only job offer I got was out in West Texas, in Odessa, Texas. We called it Odessa, but we called it Odessa or Slodessa, because there ain't a damn thing out there but horny toads and oil rigs, you know. Now there's a bunch of wind turbines. I'll get back to that in a minute. Anyway, I moved out there, and that's when, it was in 1980, and that's when the oil boom was going on. And they had a tent city out there, about 36,000 people. It was just incredible. Every wanted person in the world was living in Odessa. It was pretty rough out there. A lot of crime, a lot of bad stuff going on, and I had my little boy out there right in the middle of it. That genius that I am. But at that point, because I really wasn't making enough money to live in a boomtown, things were very expensive in a boomtown, I started getting all up in myself, and my drinking took on a new level. Now, bear in mind the logic of an alcoholic. I can't afford to pay my rent. I can't afford to buy groceries, but I'm damn sure going to buy liquor, you know, and that's the way it went. But I did well with that company, and they promoted me and moved me to Lubbock, Texas. Ain't much better than Odessa. But anyway, I get up there, and I'm now back in the corporate level driver's seat. And, I was just doing a hell of a job. I took one of their stores and just made it into some incredible income, and everybody was impressed, especially this guy's bankers. And his bankers got real close to me and came in one morning about 7 o'clock and knocked on my door before I was open and said, "Why don't you just buy this thing? We'll fund you. We'll do everything you got to do with it." I thought, hell yeah, you know, I'll do that. Well, so I went and made the offer to the owner, and he didn't like that very much. He wasn't really ready to sell, so I was out of a job again. And during that time, I had done what any good drunk would do and had mortgaged myself through the X, you know. So I not only had a horrible drinking problem, but I also had all of these other pressures coming in from the bill collectors and all this other stuff. And so, you know, fight or flight. Well, flight's the best thing I could tell, you know, let's run like hell. So we did. We ran back to Louisiana. And I really thought I had missed it, and I didn't. But the only offer that I got over there was from a guy that had just bought a big department store in Opelousas, Louisiana, called Ab Dallas, and he wanted me to come in and just put it back. It had been closed up, and he wanted me to reopen it and put it back into business. Big job for a guy like me. So I came in, and I interviewed with him, and you know, I should have known something was up when he, this guy's just under 40 years old, and he picked me up in a big Mercedes 500 and showed me his four airplanes at the airport, and then took me to his house where he had a Rolls. And I don't know, I should have known something, but no, well, me, I'm like, here I am in high cotton. You know, I got a guy that can afford to pay the bills. 3 years later, I was in court when they put him on RICO charges. But during that time, I didn't know that, and I went to work for him. It was only about 9 months later that I realized what I was into when he started forging my names on some pretty serious legal documents, and I found out about it. His best friend, the banker, was killed. Accidentally, of course. And so I quit him. The newspaper picked up the story, and I found myself one night staring down the business end of 38. While I was on my knees and had my head down, and I didn't think that was a good place to be. I got out of it. But when they say you don't quit them, they mean you don't quit them. I embarrassed him. Anyway, he came up with a bunch of federal charges on me. Now, you can imagine what my drinking had done during this time. I mean, I exploded. I was a big beer drinker, and at that time I decided that vodka, bourbon, gin, tequila, all of them tasted a whole lot better than beer. And I just tore it up. And I'm surprised I didn't get a DUI. One thing I love to do was get a good buzz on and put the keys in the ignition and rock and roll, you know. But I didn't. That's another case of God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And anyway, after he put those federal charges on me, the guy that was supposed to be prosecuting me Morgan Gudo, the DA of St. Landry Parish, started having dinner at my house every night. There was a reason for that, because he needed as much information as he could get on this guy to take him down. And needless to say, the charges were dropped and all that stuff, and this guy went to prison. Thank you. And fast forward from there to a couple of months in Alexandria, still partying like hell, fell back on my feet again, don't know how that happened, and I get moved to Atlanta. I'm a clothing buyer for a company here called Muses. Some of y'all might remember that place. And I get here, and that they historically didn't pay much, so I was back in the same Odessa situation, you know. Couldn't buy food, couldn't pay the rent. God damn it, I could drink. One thing I hated, I just remember that, I hated mail. You know, I did. I just hated mail. And either that or I loved it because I collected it in a chair. And I didn't bother to open it because it always looked so neat in the envelope, you know. And, you know, it, sometimes I'd be sitting there watching TV and the whole place would go dark. Well, that's because one of those little envelopes was my utility bill. There were a few letters from the IRS in there. There was a whole bunch of stuff that I just didn't pay attention to because it just couldn't interfere with what I was doing. And at any rate, that escalated pretty good. I remember one night we had a black tie affair, and there were a couple of VIPs there that I got to meet. Trying to remember the comedian's name from Atlanta. He used to write a bunch of books. He was a drunk, good drunk with us. Yeah, that's him. Yeah, Lewis and our mayor. And I remember that I missed throwing up on Lewis Grizzard's shoes by about that far. Because I was absolutely crocked. And, you know, my company was very proud of me that night. So I got chastised for drinking. But I guess my biggest problem with me was is my drinking never really took on any serious consequences. I mean, you know, I didn't get DUIs. I had fights with a wife, and I did stupid stuff looking back on it. All driven by ego and all driven by the trying to fit in aspect of it. And I just continued to get away with it. Then I became, well, they claim that I'm clinically depressed, but, you know, that's what they said when I got into treatment. I figured they did that so they'd get their insurance money. But regardless, I hit some roadblocks. And I lost the job at Muses when I exposed the owner for stealing the money. Not the owner, he was the CEO. It was owned by the employees, and I exposed him in a national publication for stealing the money. And people not reporting him because they were afraid they'd get fired. Well, that went in. I was kind of like deep throat, you know. Nobody knew what was going on. Nobody told them who was doing what, except they knew exactly who it was. It was me. So I'm out. And when that happened, it was difficult to find another job. That was my first stint of long-term unemployment. And you know, when you're unemployed and your wife is working and you're drawing unemployment and your dad's helping you out with a little bit of money every month, damn, you can drink a lot. Every day you can drink a lot. You can get that beer buzz in the morning starting about 8:30, 9 o'clock, you know. So that's when the consequences began and began to get worse and worse. My son, who was a teenager by that time, who was his IQ is tested off the charts. He's a classical musician in his own right. He started acting out too. I can't blame him. I mean, look what he had for a dad. What a hell of a role model, right? You know. And he started doing all kinds of things. I do remember when he was 16 years old, he walked into me and now you have to know my son. My son looks like a lumberjack. You know, he's just a strapping big boy. And he walked in one day and he sat down. And he loves shock value, so he sat down one day and told me he was gay. I just looked at him and said, "So tell me something I didn't already know." Really blew his fucking balloon. Pardon my French. Really, really popped his balloon. And so, but I wouldn't let him get one over on me. And I'll come back to him in a minute. But for the last 2 years that I was drinking, we didn't speak. If we did speak, those words I won't repeat in here. It was not good. We literally just despised each other. And I really don't know the cause for that, but we did. And my dad was also a drunk. And my dad was, bless his heart, was living in Louisiana. He was 7 years sober when he died, but he died sober. Was trying to 12-step me over the phone. Now, you know, it's hard enough 12-step somebody in person. You can imagine how hard it is over the phone, but God bless him, he never gave up trying, you know. And he wouldn't, the reason he gave me that money every month is he would not let my boy go hungry. God bless him for that too. He died in 1992. He didn't get to see me sober, but I know he knows that I am, you know, now, because he went off to the other room. But anyway, things started getting really, really bad. I went back to work for a pretty famous company, but all that did was fuel my ego again, because I had a massive ego then. And I went back to work for them, and I had the opportunity to have that 3-martini lunch, and I was having it every day, and things were just getting worse and worse. I worked for that company, though, for 9 years, so, you know, when I told them that I got sober, and I did tell them, they were all surprised. I don't know how they were surprised, because we would have meetings in the Rainbow Room in New York. I'd get drunk, get on the piano, and start singing like hell, you know, and... But I guess they never noticed that. I don't know. Maybe they were just shaking their heads saying he don't know how to control it. But they kept me on for whatever silly reason. And anyway, during that 3 years after my dad died, things went to, at my own, within my own personal self, things went to hell in a handbasket real quick. I was stealing from the store. I was stealing money from the store by going away and not coming back. And the store's business was getting screwed up. I had done very well with it. But then I started screwing it up. My wife was getting to the point where she just couldn't deal with me anymore. I would do okay Monday through Friday, but on the weekends, I would just totally blow it out. And I won't go into some of the crazy stuff that I did, but let's suffice that, you know, Dr. Phil would have a field day with it. But I remember one time she was going to leave me, and I chased her down the steps, and I stepped off the 6th step up and buried face planted in the concrete and got 3 cracks on my skull, tore my face off, and blamed it on her. That was her fault. It wasn't my fault that I was so drunk I couldn't walk. That was her fault. I even got up the next morning, I still have this too, and turned the camera around and took a picture of myself. So I guess I'd see what you did. You know, God, aren't we great people? But anyway, I started seeing things falling apart around me, and this was serious. I had made a few trips to an AA meeting here or there, picked up a white chip and a 12-pack right afterwards, and went home and said, "Here's my white chip." Carried my 12-pack and put it in the refrigerator. I had no intention. I was just trying to get the heat off. But I remember on Cinco de Mayo, 1995. Now, I ain't Mexican. But I started out at a Mexican restaurant with some, you know, those big-ass margaritas. Big ones, you know. I mean, the kind that normal people would take four people and four straws and they'd still leave half of it, you know. Well, I think I had four or five of them, you know. I don't know. But I was rocking and rolling pretty good when I got home, and my neighbor across the way, they were a bunch of young hippies, and I was an old hippie. They were young hippies, so we got along great. And they had this long, red, 6-foot-long thing that had this little green stuff burning in the end of it, and I went off on that too. And saying that's the purpose, I won't talk any more about that, but that was a big part of my story. And at any rate, I don't remember that night much. I just know that I kept going like the ever-ready bunny. And I never passed out. I never did anything. That's the thing. Right when I got towards the end, I didn't know how much it was going to take to get me blitzed. Or I wouldn't feel anything. Or I used to call it drinking myself sober. Yeah. But I never knew what it would be. And this time, apparently, I got drunk and kept on going, man. I used to wake up in the mornings on a Sunday morning and tell my wife, thanks for driving me home. And, of course, she was out drinking, too. And she'd say, I would. And I'd look outside, car be all up on the curb. I'd wake up in the mornings and I'd say, who do I need to call to apologize to? Because I was a real smart ass, you know. I'd do all kinds of stuff. And this morning I woke up and nobody could look at me. I looked down and the four horsemen were at the end of my bed, man. They were talking to me again. It visited me a few times and that. But the remorse was just intense. I can't explain it. It was just intense. And it wasn't one of those, oh, no, I'm screwed up now. No, it wasn't that. It was just horrible. It was sadness that I felt for me. Not for those around me, but for me. And I said, I can't do this anymore. And I bet I had said, God, I need help 10,000 times. But I said it again that morning. I said, God, I need help. And by noon, I was checked in Charter Petrie. I went in and told my wife, I want to go to treatment. She said, well, you make the effing call. I'm not. I said, okay. It's a good thing she did that. You know, I mean, it wasn't like she was trying to cover for me or anything. Of course, 30 days sober, I found out she had been a year in Al-Anon. And she, by that time, she had her third-degree black belt. And of course, I never noticed it. She's gone out. That was more time for me to drink. I didn't know she was going to an Al-Anon meeting. But let me tell you, buddy, early in the program, they ain't your friend. But anyway, yeah, they get sick with us, you know. They do. And I checked myself in on May the 6th, and thank God, that was my first, and not my first, but that was the time that it stuck, and I don't know why. I just know that it did. I don't question why, because I might not want to know, but I know that it has worked for me every day since then. And I keep everything in the day. So I started opening the envelopes then, you know, because you have to make all these financial amends and all that crap. Oh God, I suffered under that for a long time. But anyway, I started, I lost my train of thought on that. But I started doing things that I was supposed to be doing. Ernie grabbed me I asked him, but he, then after I asked him and he agreed to be my sponsor, he very quickly took me through the steps. And with the exception of the fourth step, that one, after I did the number three, he told me, he said, when you're ready, we're going to do number four. Well, I turned that into a year span. And I sat on that third step so long, got splinters in my butt. And I don't recommend that to anyone. But I sat down and I did my four step. And then we went 5 through 12 very quickly, because I was, by that time I was ready, I had to adjust myself. Thank God for that. I was prepared for the next thing I was going to have to go through, which was my son, who had gone to Indiana University on a music scholarship. When he got there, you know, of course, drunks don't have a whole lot of money, you know, and even though I was not drinking and all that money was getting put back into the funds, it was getting sent out to people it was owed to. So he was up at school without a whole lot of money, so he started organizing raves to make his money. And I think he was doing okay at it. But I couldn't find him one weekend. And when I did find him, I found him in Bloomington Hospital, where he had OD'd on heroin. And, man, that was tough. That was tough, especially because the Christmas before that, after I had been sober a few days, I was sober in May, it was December, my first sober Christmas. I was laying in the bed, and that big-ass boy climbed up in the bed behind me and put his arm around me and said, I love you, Dad. That's the first words he had spoken to me in about a year and a half. I ain't going to tell you guys, but that man, that crushed me. It really did. It really did. But anyway, we started getting along a little bit better. But when this happened, I was just like, oh, hell, what do I do? And thank God for this program is all I can say. And thank God for my dad trying to 12-step me over the telephone. You know? My dad not one time judged me. Not one time. He just kept telling me that he loved me and he helped I could find my way. And he kept telling me when I get tired of getting my ass kicked, give him a call. He could help me. You know? So my son kept coming in. After he got thrown out of school, I sent him a bus ticket and told him to, when he got out of the hospital, to go to the UPS store and have all his stuff packed up because I wasn't coming to get him. But he could come home. And he came home, and it was a year and a half before he was ready. No, it was not quite a year. I'm sorry. That's not right. It's not quite a year. During that time, he moved to Philadelphia. He ripped off his drug dealer. He was almost killed. And I snuck him home. He got home. We went through a lot of hell with that boy. And all I would do to him was just what my dad did to me. And that was to say, when you get tired of getting your ass whipped, give me a call. So one day I was at work, and of course now I had the 12 steps on the wall in my house as soon as you walked in too. So he always says in his story that didn't help. But at any rate, I got a call one day when I was at work. And this is a God thing. And he said, Daddy, I'm tired. I said, okay, I can help you. And I knew some people in the recovery business by that time. I had a little over a year. And I called him up and I said, look, he's not insured. He's over 18 years old. He has no money. And I certainly can't pay for it. I said, what do we do? I got a call back in about 20 minutes and said, bring him here. I said, I can't afford you, because they were like $1,000 a day. They said, bring him here. I said, okay. So I did, and they put him through a 90-day program, and at the end of it, they charged me $5. Now tell me if that's not a God thing, you know. And that boy has not had a drink or a drug since then. He's now an attorney in New York City, looking for work, of course, but he's done well for himself, you know. Oh, that and everything about me to this program. There ain't no reason I should even be alive and standing here. You know, I used to never think I was going to live past 30. I figured I got, I'm 55 now. I got 25 years of bar time, you know. When you come in into the folds of this program, there are people that you don't know. There are things, a lot of things you don't know about what you got to do to try to help yourself and try to stay sober. It can get a lot confusing sometimes, you know. It can get overwhelming to a brand newcomer. And they just looked at me and they hugged me and they'd say, just keep coming back. Just keep coming back. And I did. And gradually I figured out everything on my own, you know. You got to get a sponsor. You got to get this. You got to do this. You got to read that book. And that book weighed 1,000 pounds the first time I ever picked it up. But this was my lifeline now, you know. And after you get in it and you've been working at it for a while, then you start reaching your hand out to other people. And man, you have never had the miracle of this program until you've had the miracle of working with others. That's what keeps you sober. I didn't take a sponsee until I was about 3-4 years sober. I'd refer them to my sponsor. I did it because I didn't figure that I knew enough and I didn't want to hurt anybody. You know? I mean, Lord, when I came in this thing, if y'all would have told me to go stand upside down in a bottle of acid, I would have. I mean, you know, I wanted to stay sober and I just didn't want to hurt anybody. And I'm glad I took that little bit of time to do that. But when I got my first one, it was really, really rewarding to me. And, you know, he kept saying, you know, thanks. I'm like, no, thank you, man. You're the one who keeps me sober. You keep my nose in the middle of this book, you know, where it needs to be. I've had pigeons that have gone out. I've had buried three, two suicides and one natural causes, which the natural cause guy was still sober. The other two were not. That's a very hard thing, is to bury one of your pigeons. Very hard. They tell you when you get into this program to go buy yourself a dark suit. They mean that. I've been to a lot of AA funerals. But AA funerals are different than regular funerals anyway. There's a sense of, if they die sober, there's a sense of joy that's there because you know that they accomplished what they wanted to accomplish and they've gone on to the other room. When you go to one that's somebody that's gone out and didn't pass through it, you feel a deeper sense of sorrow, I think, than anybody else, because you know that they could have, if they would have accepted the help, they could have gotten the help. You know, acceptance is a very hard thing for us. We always think we're different. We always think we're, well, we're like that old cliche, you know, egomaniacs with an inferiority complex. Well, you know, that's true, because we do have a large inferiority complex, and we overcome it with ego. That's the only way we know how to do it. That's our defense mechanisms. And we drink to kill that pain. I don't have that pain anymore today. I have a deep, deep sense of gratitude that here I am with my 13th sober, 14th sober Christmas. You know? Had my 14th sober Thanksgiving. I go places where people are actually glad to see me now. I don't know why, because I still know that I'm a jerk. But, you know, they don't see that, you know. I still have all my character defects. I call them like they're on a little switchboard, like in an airplane. I can switch them on and switch them off when I want to. I just don't choose to reach down there much. When I do, I need to get to a meeting like tonight. But all in all, I think I'm a little bit better person than I used to be. I'm a lot better person than I used to be. At least I'm a lot calmer than I used to be. And at least I'm not upset in the world like I used to. And, you know, not trying to kill myself and all of those around me. That's about all I got. And I appreciate you guys having me up here tonight. I didn't no intention of talking when I came here, but thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Dick. Great work on short notice, for sure. Very helpful to me in particular to hear that, and definitely carrying the message instead of the mess here. So we thank you. And the baskets going around, Seventh Tradition states that there are no dues or fees for AA membership, but we can't put this program on without a little bit of help from you guys. So anything you can afford, we greatly appreciate. And I've asked Julie to hand out the checks.
I'm Julie, I'm an alcoholic, and we have a chip system. We have a white chip for coming in for the first time, surrendering to our program one day at a time. Would you like a white chip? Anybody else want a white chip? Any other white chips? All right, we have a silver chip for 30 days, nights in a row. Red is 90 days. We have 90 days. About 6 months. Yellow. Green. How about birthdays? Anybody have a birthday? All right, well, congratulations on your day. Bye.
Thank you, Julie, and congratulations on making the decision. Some of the guys here will be coming up to you afterwards, welcoming you in, back into the program or into the program, and offering you phone numbers. So I'm sure you can find help here. Now we have a chance to make AA-related announcements, NAVA or other ones. Yes, sir. And Santa Claus will be here the 19th, 1 to 4. And that's a Sunday or Saturday? Sunday. That's right, Sunday. Yes, Mark.
Mark, alcoholic.
Hey, Mark. Thank you, Mark. And next week, we've got George S. scheduled. He's got a birthday, an AA birthday on December 20th. So he'll be picking up 8 years of sobriety days, 2002. And we see him here at NAVA a lot, and his home group is the Biscayne Room that we've had enough group. So you probably have a pretty good, some of you probably have a pretty good idea who George is. And that's a story not to be missed. And the following week we have Donald S., who has been struggling with leukemia. And he told a story last year and contacted me and said he wanted an opportunity to tell a story again while he still had the strength. And so Donald S., not really sure of his sobriety date at this time, but that's irrelevant. But he's currently scheduled for December 27th. Thanks to cooperation from the other scheduled speakers. And if we could get a little help and cleaning up, looking around, picking up cups, and maybe helping us with the coffee machine and that kind of stuff, and straightening the chairs, we'd appreciate it. You got anything, Tim? Okay. Well, unless anybody has it. In another announcement, I'd like to remind everybody that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. And for those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer.
Okay. to me, you can send you.
Sober.
Lord, our hands, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
If you come back, it's work for us. It's work for us. You know, anyway, you can't have the same.